There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Okay, well, welcome everyone again to another episode of the Middle Chamber. This is actually episode number 9 of the new sequence with the SyncBook Radio Network lineup. So we're really excited. We've had some really great feedback from all the shows we're having. A lot of people are listening and downloading, and we're really excited about the response we're getting. It looks like we're on some really good tracks, and in light of that, we have the return of a guest that was on just a few episodes ago, which you can find these episodes in several places. You can go directly to the source, which is the SyncBook Radio Network on our Middle Chamber page, and there are all the former episodes that are there. You can also go to the Facebook page, FraterX, MaterX, and find the episodes there. And you can also go to Stitcher Radio, the Middle Chamber, and the guest today is Andrea Venimus, and on just to remind everyone, he came on a few shows ago and talked to us about his new book, or his fascinating book, Hands-on Chaos Magic. And let me just let you know about Andrea. He is he's the author of this modern magical classic, and it's the title is Hands-on Chaos Magic: Reality Manipulation Through the Ovaki Current. And we didn't really get into that subject so much in the last conversation, so I was hoping we could kind of touch upon that specifically in our conversation with him today. He's also published in Magic on the Edge Anthology, the Manifesting Prosperity Anthology, the Pop Culture Anthology, and Best of Kauntan Magazine Anthology. And he holds the highest initiatory rank in Haitian voodoo, that of Hogan Asagwe. Is that how you say it? Asagwe, Andrea?
Yep.
Okay, and is a Usai, am I saying that right? Usai and Karuna, Reiki master, as well as neuro-linguistic programming practitioner and a licensed hypnotherapist. He currently is on the faculty over at Peter Carroll's Arcanorium College, and we'd also like to speak to him about the college, because as a matter of fact, I have several listeners that have a great interest in this online school that's available. Basically, occult fundamentals is what I'd call it, but it's from the perspective of, we consider postmodern magic is a good way to classify it. Would you agree with that, Andrea?
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, postmodern. Okay. Although I think somebody probably has that term copyrighted too, so who knows, right?
Hey, this is this is just free and clear radio frontier, you know, so we can say anything we want. We're not even beholden by FCC regulations here. We're that wild and unrestrained, just the way we like it, right, everyone? Okay, so having said that, I want to welcome you, sir, and thank you for sparing us some of your time, and also, unbeknownst to the listeners out there, thank you for bearing with me with the technical issues. I'm really hoping, keep our fingers crossed, say whatever supplications and invocations you can out there, everyone. Hopefully this will go over well. And again, It is a struggle with our technology. It's a blessing and a curse, a double-edged sword, if you will. On one side, I embrace the accessibility and instantaneous communications in the multimedia content revenue or venues and revenues if they come in. But in the other sense, becoming reliant upon these mediums, when things go wrong, you are utterly frustrated because you realize the tenuous grip you hold in any circumstance. And it's hard to accept the limitations when they are obstacles in the way of, what we want, I guess, or what we expect, results we expect. And so I struggle with my own limitations. I struggle with my own ability to sort of maneuver through, navigate through. There's a saying that says we can't control the winds, we can only adjust our sails. And oftentimes I feel that I fall back on things like that to try to get me through those moments. And so having said that, I want to welcome Andrea Vitamus and to open the conversation to him. And just basically, I think that we didn't really have time in the conversation we had last time to get into the second half of the book and also to talk specifically about the Olveiki current within the premise of this treatise that you've presented us with, Hands-On Chaos Magic and the Reality Manipulation through this. So I wanted to kind of open up the conversation there, Andrea Vitamus, and ask you to, could you expound for the listeners on what was the circumstances around which you received this method and talk about all that went into that?
Well, I mean, it took several years for me to write Hands-On Chaos Magic, and for the people who support me, and thank you for supporting me, I realize it's taken me almost as long to start writing another book. Hands-On Chaos Magic really came about because I felt like in the greater occult sphere, there just wasn't books like it. I know that there's some how-to books, but there really isn't. There's mostly theoretical books that deal with paradigms, and Peter Carroll's books are excellent, but they are very theoretical. And when I started out in magic, I needed to know, how do I do stuff now? Because things were breaking down. And by things breaking down, I mean people around me would see shadows move, all kinds of weird stuff that in classical sense would be a shamanic initiation. And being more of a scientist, I wanted to break that down as best I could to understand, well, how do you deal with this? How do you get this hands-on experience? You know, how do I engineer magic? How do I re-engineer and get useful techniques? What are the best practices? How do I understand what I'm doing, you know, from a modern point of view, which is very difficult given that I was pretty much pretty close to an atheist, or at least an agnostic, when I had to get thrown in a deep end of magic.
Well, I certainly understand. First of all, let me just address what you said at the beginning about the long writing process. I can completely relate to the how we're sort of along for the ride, aren't we, when we agree to do a project or, you know, agree with, make an agreement with ourselves to take on the task of creating a work that you could then, you know, deliver to others and have them read it and try to, you know, keep a continuity of thought and hit all the bases that you want within the work. It's a difficult process, and I know that my own listeners have heard me discuss for several years now the book I'm working on, which is The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, which, again, it takes time. It's a 7-year project, 5 years or 4 years of talking about it and gathering research material, and then 3 years of actually starting and creating an outline and turning it into chapters, and now having a over 160-page document manuscript that I'm preparing to give to publishers, you know? So I understand that. That's a huge undertaking.
Well, and I tend to write what I know. So it's not like Hands-On Chaos Magic was written after I'd already learned it. And it was written to try to get to my understanding at that point of the most effective things that you had to know before you could go to any grimoires, before you could do any other really kind of more paradigmal magics, you know, before you could slip in and open up the Goetia, or before you could slip in and open up angel magic, there's a lot you have to know about magic that it's usually skipped over in books. And if you are actually having manifestations and weird things happen that isn't just in your head, as in other people are verifying they saw these weird things happen, and you don't know anything about magic, well, you have to learn the hard way. Now, that's kind of what hands-on chaos magic is an attempt so people don't have to learn the hard way. In a training guide, basically, you know, that'll walk you through the point that if you did everything in hands-on chaos magic, and actually really sat down, did the exercises, from the breathing on through the focus, on through all the different styles of enchantment, evocation, invocation, you would have a baseline understanding and competency to pick up any other occult book and get it to work. And you'd know if it doesn't work, you'd kind of know why what their stuff doesn't work and what you have to do to go and get it. So instead of a book that will tell you, you know, endless morals or lay out endless symbols, it's like, these are how the symbols actually work. This is how you actually put things together. This is how you use your actual brain to make the magic actually happen. So that way, when you go do something else, you'll know. You'll be able to get actually real world results and not just kind of wonder if it's working or not.
And, you know, I know from studying your work and hearing you speak that one of the most essential, fundamental and essential aspects to magical practice is journaling, is actually, you know, putting down a report, an account of your progress, so that you can. That's what you just said. You didn't write the book till after you had learned it, and you learned it through practice, and you wrote about what you learned. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, we know from the sciences that the universe has various structures. We might not know everything, but even if we look at other people's behavior, even when we're talking to each person, we can look at the structure of speech and know, okay, here you go. We can do the same thing with magic. We can look at the structure of magic and say, what do you really need to know? And yeah, it wasn't until after I'd already spent a good, I'd already been doing magic for 10 years before I even started writing the book. So I already knew how this stuff worked and where I would get in trouble. It wasn't like I was pulling the information just from other books and doing academic research. It's really kind of like I sat down, I opened up a vein and poured it out.
Sure, I understand. And that's, that, in many ways, it's almost an automatic process. It unfolds. I feel oftentimes as if I'm involved in this inner alchemy, an alchemical process, and certain conditions have to be just right. And once they're right, everything locks in and it just flows. Like you said, open a vein, it flows out, you know?
Yep.
And you talk about engineering magic and results. And this is when we speak of this book and how, you know, I know from reading the book that you, in within the pages, you discuss how you received this system. And the how this system sort of unfolded, the Ovechi system. Can you talk about that some and sort of elaborate for the listeners to just what that is and how you received that?
This is going to be exciting for some people and disappointing for other people.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Ovechi is the name of the real name of the book, right? So the book has an egregore that I created using the techniques of the book to help me finish the book and to help me understand what would make the book complete and to give the book its own spirit.
And for those listening, you use the term egregore, which is like a magical thought form, to put it into more layman terms, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I could go into specifically. I went into a very deep shamanic journey and looked at the book when it was completed and got basically created a spirit of the book at the future time it was finished, before it was finished, and then brought that back with me and used that kind of time magic to figure out what should be in the book and to help give me encouragement through finishing it off. So Ovaiki is actually the name of the finished egregore, the finished book in its totality, which is a little bit weird because I'm talking about going back and forth in time, but that says a lot about how what kinds of stuff you can do with magic, is that you can look into the future and kind of pick a pathway that you want to go down and create stuff like this to bring back with you to guide you. So it's literally like the book, I created something from the future to kind of cheat and make sure that the book could get finished.
That's amazing and hyperdimensional all at once. But you know, it's so right on. I listen, when I'm listening to what you're saying, it seems so right to me, because the fundamentals of magic is the shamanistic journey. All magic sprung forth from shaman consciousness. So it's not unlikely that you would describe this experience in which you could, you know, what my people might consider like remote viewing, because that's what is at the fundamental, the paranormal experience. And so it's exciting. I think you're onto something. So please continue.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that shamans used to get training for a lot of years, and I prefer much more shamanic styles of magic than, say, ceremonial magic. So I admit that. But shamans used to get a lot of training before they would go on those journeys, which now it's kind of like, okay, you get a weekend and everyone gets to call themselves a shaman, but that's not at all it. People would train for lots of years to understand how to do it. In a lot of cases, I had to spend the 10 years working on magic before I could do something like go to the future in a journey and, you know, use binaural beats to help me get there, go deep and then pull, have contact with a thought form. This isn't magic 101. I mean, it can be very easily if you can break it down, but all of those things that I'm talking about in Hands Like Chaos Magic are prerequisites. Like, can you focus? Can you get your body in certain states of consciousness? Like, can you calm yourself down? Can you focus on an intention? Can you move energies around? Can you, you know, make links to other places? Can you call a spirit to you? All of these are prerequisites before you get to the point you can start diving down into the future and calling a spirit from the future into right now, or calling a spirit from the past, or basically, I think your listeners understand. There's a lot of times it's just a matter of these kind of simple, very simple tricks in magic done repetitively get to the point of mastery. And once you understand that, well, while your life may not be perfect, it will get better. And, you know, that future pacing, that's exactly how I've done it. Now, I'm struggling with the next book because I haven't future paced it yet.
Are you going to do it that time? Are you going to do it the same thing as last time? You're going to go that route?
I don't know. I'm thinking about journaling. I'm thinking about going down to the elemental planes of fire and getting some teachers to help me, because it's a book on fire magic. But I've been doing this for 6 years, so it's not.
Yeah,
like,
I've seen you. I've actually heard you speak about this. Yes,
I've been doing it for 6 years. There's a couple book projects that I have, but I've been working on fire magic for like 6 years because I needed to. It isn't that. Ooh, wouldn't it be cool if I wrote a book on fire magic? I mean, there's a million candle books out there, so I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. That's one of the difficulties of writing a new book. But my personal experience doesn't exactly jive with the way a lot of the candle books are written. But I think it does jive with other people who work with fire in a magical sense. And why you would work with fire in a magical sense, in the modern era, and why it's probably so critical. Because, again, people right now, for the most part, we have issues with not just survival, but just vitality, because our culture is not helpful for us at all with vitality. It's actually counterproductive. Almost every component of our society drains our energy in an energetic sense. There's too many distractions. There's too many what would be considered like vampirism in a way. And that vampirism is actually predicted and expected. It's part of what the Hindus would call the Kali Yuga. That's what the Age of Darkness is. But you can get that vitality back, that magical oomph in your system, by doing fire magic in certain ways and understanding how you're connecting to the fire and then get the oomph from the fires itself. I'm fascinated. I've been, after I had one kind of karmic incident that I had to really adjust to, I've been working on this for a little while. For that reason, because we all have too many distractions, we have too many things weighing us down, so we have to actually not only have our magic give us, you know, what we want in life, but actually give us the strength to go out and get what we want to in life. So that's why I've been working on the fire magic, because I find it not only fascinating, I find it to be enlivening, which is one of the critical problems of the modern age, is that it takes away our passion, our enlivenment. It dulls things down, and, you know, everything's a Twitter post or everything's a Facebook post, and there's no passion to actually live, which is one of the first things you have to regain to really get effective at magic.
Yeah, we use the term around here, the desacralization of reality, the removal of the sacred. And how that, you know, that sacred element is part of that exciting, you know, zeal that we have in the experiences that we involve ourselves in by cultivating a rich inner experience. And you sound like you, like myself, approach these things as an educational experience. So in writing the book, you're not only learning about the fire magic, you know, you're producing the work. So it's a learning experience as well, because you don't find evidence of it in, you know, all concise into one modified work. So you see a need. It's like you see a vacuum in the universe that requires filling. You bring your creative expression to that and put it in there. And that's exciting. I think it's a dynamic approach. And I wanted to also comment on how you spoke of how you take the more shamanic approach, you know, the shaman's path. And I too resonate with that. What I've sort of done is sort of to modify a ceremonial magic and a shamanic path together and create a sort of an innovative system that's got both. You know, the hope in my mind. And also, you spoke of the Kali Yuga. And I mentioned to you at the beginning when we were setting up the show that I was reading the Anthology of Sorcery by the over at the Coetting camp. I know you are familiar with Eric Coetting, and he's a great guy and all. And so his work is really stands alone as well. And in that first chapter, he speaks about the gods of the Kali Yuga. And I like what he says, because I think it goes along with what you're saying. He talks about the Age of Darkness in a sense being not something to lose hope about, but being the realization that we manifest the divine. There's a vacuum, an emptiness. The divine has not manifested on Earth in the Kali Yuga. We manifest it. That's why we are conditioned by those who would control us, the powers that should not be in our society, to ignore or be afraid of systems like magical approaches to reality, which would empower us and give us the connection to draw down the divine forces into ourselves and then express them creatively. Would you not agree?
Yeah, that is certainly part of the Kali Yuga. You know, a lot of other aspects of this, and by all means, I'm not, you know, I don't want to say that I'm a strong part of, you know, or Hindu priest, but a lot of it has to do with what we exactly see in practice. The mind control is part of it, where everything gets unbelievably difficult, where spirituality is unbelievably suppressed. But probably what Eric doesn't talk a lot about is that there's a promise made to everyone in the Kali Yuga in this age. And it's a very kind of simple promise from the Vedics, which basically says for the true seekers, there will always be the resources. Meaning that while it seems like the obstacles are overwhelming in the Kali Yuga, the people, and there will be very few of them, who actually try to dive in and understand the various mysteries, whatever traditions they are, and try to recreate the sacred and be sacred, will find that they have the resources. And I've certainly found that in my life, you know.
Sure. I just wanted to cut in and say that, you know, he actually does, in fact, offer that sort of optimistic stance as well, that what you just said, you know, the idea that there are the means, there are the tools, it is accessible. We don't have to fret or, you know, fear not, you know, there is a way out of this, right?
Yeah, and if we look at it, right, I mean, I don't like the fact that there's a million competitors now on CreateSpace and anyone is just publishing a book, but really, the information's out there. There's not really anything you could want to know. You know, an author like myself, I would hopefully have a voice you like, and, you know, hopefully you enjoy the artistic creation of my book, and it's very helpful. But the truth is that any secrets that you want to know are out there in some capacity. Whether or not you do anything with them is the challenge of the Kali Yuga. It's the challenge of where we're at. So the information's out there. There's still a million distractions to stop you from using it.
I totally agree. And that's the stance I take as well with all that I've researched in the esoteric orders and occult systems that I've looked into and joined and worked and practiced. That the bottom line to everyone listening is that anything you want to know is available. It's out there, but you have to activate your own will. You have to actually pursue it. You have to, in a lot of ways, you have to engage. If you want to know a thing, you know, you have to do something to learn about it. You can't just read a few whatever, you know, concise abridgments or whatever and think that you speak about a thing. And in our world today, everything is simplified and boiled down and deconstructed too much. That's part of the whole desacralization of our reality. In the process, we lose the kernel. We lose the life force. It's like white bread. You know, when you white bread on the shelf, it'll last forever because there's nothing live in there. The endosperm's been, you know, excised out. Whereas wheat bread or a whole grain bread, it won't last as long because there's life that goes bad in the bread. You know, it's bad sitting on the shelf. But they did that for marketing, you know, and in industrial reality, they need to move a bunch of loaves of bread. But in nutritional the approach, you want whatever people say you shouldn't eat bread today. I'm just using it as an analogy. But you want the whole food, the real food, you know, you don't want the boiled down starchy supplement, you know, substitution, you know, so it is important. I'm with you what you say about, yeah, the market is flooded with voices and opinions and books and podcasts, and there's so much. And, you know, it's important to discern, to look and listen, because I've had some pretty shady experiences with broadcasters out there who claim that they're truthers and they're freedom this or revolution that or whatever, you know what I mean? And then the bottom line is, it's just somebody who can afford to pay for a stream, who has their own little soapbox, you know what I mean? And they call themselves the owner of a network or whatever, or the owner of a magazine or whatever, and they, you know, that it's not necessarily what it appears to be, everybody. And somebody coming forth as an expert and offering opinions, you do want to use critical thinking and discernment and not just accept wholesale what everybody's, you know, proposing. And having said that, I think it's remarkable that you brought up when you speak of the current, the Ovaki current, you mentioned the thought forms and the egregore. Because I wrote that down as one of the topics of our discussion, you know, thought forms and egregores. And I wanted to sort of pick your brain about what you thought about the different classifications therein. Because, of course, you mentioned the magical thought form, which is the most fundamental technical tool for magic that you can conjure, that you can manifest in a ceremony, a ritual, for those who aren't familiar with what I'm speaking of. But there's other aspects to the egregores and the Gregories and it's actually connected to the Watchers and the Nephilim. And I wanted to know what your thoughts were on this and what you could offer in the way of experience and insight into the other aspects of magical thought forms and disembodied spirits in general.
Well, first, I'm going to give a blatant plug, if I may.
Of course.
I'll be teaching a whole webinar on Thought Form Servitors and Artificial Spirits on July 12th at 3 p.m. So if you go to my webpage, AndreaVitimus.com, and upcoming appearances, you can click on there and you'll see that I'm doing that. So this is an excellent lead-in to what I'll be teaching kind of very soon, actually. So with that said, and that blatant plug out there, thought forms, egregores, and all these words are, they're words like energy and God and goddess. Everyone seems to have different definitions. So I'm going to start with the general definitions that I tend to use. So servitors kind of take a whole class of artificial spirits that are usually programmed. You can create servitors from basically your mind and give them programming, and they're very limited kind of spirits that go off and do what you tell them to do. And usually there's different ways to make them, and usually, you know, they're great. They go from very simple to more complex, but you generally have complete control over them because you're building them from your mind and kind of keeping track of them and knowing what they do. Now, usually thought forms have a more nuanced meaning because there's lots of things that could be thought forms that may or may not be what is considered classical. You program a servitor. It could be television show characters have a thought form attached to them. Relationships might have a thought form that gets unconsciously created between two people. There's all kinds of things that can have a thought form that you can communicate with that may not have directly been created by you. It may have been created by the situation. It may be just that the thought form is a way to encapsulate the different variables between two people, or between what you're looking at, and communicate with it in a spiritual way. Some of those thought forms, in a shamanic way, really, some of those thought forms can communicate very well, and others may be more limited depending on what you're trying to do and what you're trying to communicate with. Egregores is another complicated thing because, you know, if you're a classical, old-school chaos magician, you might say something like all of the gods and goddesses are just egregores that we create in our cultural subconscious, unconscious, and that pretty much is, these are ancestral egregores or ancestral spirits that have grown in power by being around. You know, one way to look at it is, you know, even a group has an egregore. If you do Golden Dawn magic, the egregore of the Golden Dawn, in whatever form it's in now, you know, encompasses the people in the group. It encompasses the techniques that the group has. It covers a lot of the overriding picture. And there's a really good example of what egregores are in the modern terms is corporations. In a corporation, it's usually not enough to just work for the corporation. That isn't enough. It's, you are a cog in the corporation. You are part of the corporation, of this overall thing. It's still an artificial spirit in a way, but it's an artificial spirit that has now put you into a certain role, a certain machine, a certain cog in the wheel of this greater thing. And that kind of is what egregores do. And you can look at various cult orders and see this definition applies to them as well. It's not just that you are part of the group, it's that the egregore of the group is acting on you, and that you are acting on the group egregore to a point.
That's really exciting. I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to kind of, before you moved away from this statement you just made, because it's a really, I think, exciting and intriguing analogy that you're making when you talk about corporations. I hadn't really thought of this, but, you know, you're absolutely right. Because when you join a corp, I've worked for several large corporations in my life, and when you join a corporation, you're required to adjust your awareness, to adjust your consciousness, sometimes to adopt certain ways of speech. You have to think in certain ways. You have to, you know, sort of lock your frequency into step with the corporate body, as it were. And so it's really does, I can see why you make that analogy. And when you think about the egregores in, say, for Freemasonic lodges, I mean, you're the people initiated into them, you don't realize going in that you're going to make adjustments to your awareness just interacting. And like you said, multi-generational organizations where, for example, the Golden Dawn, the egregore morphs and shifts and adjusts and modifies. It's sort of in keeping with, as much as it attempts to modify, the awareness of those who come into contact with it.
Yeah, and that's good and bad. I mean, it's good if you have a spiritual, a true spiritual uplifting philosophy. It's bad if you're maybe a corporate culture that's infecting somebody's life to be more, less autonomous. And it's still an artificial, it's still what would be kind of like an artificial spirit, but it's artificial is the wrong word here, because just because it's somebody set down a business plan and created all this and created the culture, it doesn't mean it doesn't have an impact.
Maybe we should say intentional instead of artificial.
Yeah, I mean, maybe intentional is a better word. I mean, the reason that I say that corporations are very much like egregores is that it's not enough just to show up to do your job. If people haven't had worked for mainly small businesses, you know, you get into kind of family vibe, but that's an egregore in itself, right? But in a real corporation, it's explicitly stated it's not enough to do your job. Your performance and your thing is partially based upon how well you reflect and become the corporate culture. That is an egregore. You know, likewise in the Golden Dawn groups, not to be, you know, insulting, I mean, a lot of OTO groups, any of it is really like, you know, how well do you mesh with the egregore of the group, as it were?
Yeah, and I like to remind people, you're making a really good point here, what you're the kind of going around the subject of the Golden Dawn or any of these orders. You know, it really is in voluntary organizations, it's an on basis, based on each individual group is what you're going to get. People can't think in terms of like all practitioners of this one or all of that. They're all like this just because one lodge is one way or one temple is one way.
Usually there are overriding egregore concerns, and then there will be temple concerns, and those may not be the same. You know, those and the different and we're swimming in a sea of these kind of systems all the time. So I mean, you know. You know, I've done chaos magic for a while, and I'm a member in good standing with IoT, but I really don't get along with the egregore anymore or the vibe of the people. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, that just, there's no problem with that. It just means what it is. I mean, and oftentimes the egregore will then ostracize people or otherwise do things if you're not quite pulling the line. And people have to understand these are in play. If it's a formalized egregore, that is actually happening. You know, that's good and bad. It can be used for good. It can be used for bad. There's no judgment on my part.
Well, having qualified as such, now let's move to the subject of the college that you are involved in, that you do willingly associate with and are one of the faculty of, and that is the Arcanorium College?
Yeah, the Arcanorium College, which is Peter Carroll's university. Peter Carroll was pretty much the founder of Chaos Magic with a few others.
Could you give us the website on that, please? I'm sorry, I'm trying to find it here.
But it's Arcanorium College. If you go Peter Carroll Arcanorium College, you'll be able to pull it right up.
Sure, it's arcanoriumcollege.com.
Yep. And I occasionally teach classes there. It's been a little while since I taught a class there, but I'm working on teaching another class there soon.
Oh, I see right away here on the front page we have this thing called the Epoch or the Epoch. Can you tell us anything about this?
Oh, that's Peter Carroll's new book. So that's what he just published about 2 weeks ago. So not 2 weeks, but 2 months ago.
Wow, it looks exciting.
It's a pretty good book. It's details a biplanetary correspondence system for various different entities. And you can take the mappings and ideas that Peter comes up with and apply it to a biplanetary mapping for almost any set of spirits. So,
and then, of course, within the system of the Arcanorum College, there is an initiatory order, too, Knights of Chaos, correct?
Yeah, there is. There is. And I don't know if it's particularly so formal to say initiatory and you get initiated, and it's more like you decide to step up to the plate and do something, and then you can do stuff. What the Knights of Chaos are basically about is, once you get a baseline competency of magic, many magicians might feel like things are a little out of control in our general society. So they actually try to magically attack various corporations and get them to get under control, so that way they're manageable, that somebody manages them. Sometimes, a couple times, they have succeeded, and other times they have not. Corporations, even based on our conversation today, putting into a framework as an egregore, have their own defenses.
As in active agents of defense?
Yeah, they have defenses. It's not quite trivial to attack a corporation directly. It's not like they don't have all of this life force and energy behind them, based on the people that they make new cogs. And I know that's a very controversial statement. Some people might disagree with me, but it's been my experience and the Knights of Chaos experience that they have some defenses. It takes a fair amount of cleverness to get around it and cause them to stumble.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's really, it's actually kind of sort of refreshing to hear that there's people actually fighting this fight, to be honest with you.
Well, most of the times, occultists can't agree on the color of shit, but...
exactly. you know, so to collaborate is a pretty big statement, right?
Well, in a way, there are people already who like Peter Carroll, so there's already kind of a egregore of that going on. There's already people who like the Arcanorum College, so it's kind of self-selecting the people who are probably, you know, already in tune with that.
I know that I'm incredibly intrigued, and I'm interested in, I mean, I've kind of toying with the idea of taking a course or two myself of joining and, you know, getting a membership there, because I'm very drawn to the subject matter myself.
Yeah, one of the things is that all the courses from before are up there, and now they actually do have a degree program where they walk you through, and various mentors test you on the competency levels to make sure you have basic competency.
Yeah, well, another order that I belong to, well, there's two other orders that I belong to. One of them is the Builders of the Aditum, which is Paul Foster Case's order. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also a member of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, which is run by Archdruid John Michael Greer, was 30 years or 25 years in the Golden Dawn system. And he also is in the Ovates Bards and Druids system in Europe with Philip Cargom, and those guys are no joke. I mean, it's taken me, I'm on the fourth year since I first began in the Ancient Order of Druids, and I'm just now a Druid apprentice. So 3 years of work to get to just being a Druid apprentice. And, you know, I basically, you plant a tree. I mean, you gotta, you gotta steward the tree. It's a lot of journaling. There's a lot of discursive meditation. There's a lot of practice. There's a lot of memorization. There's a lot of, and you have to qualify. You have to prove that you are proficient to advance. So it's not a joke. And that's what people, I try to make that clear myself when I'm talking about, this is a system. It's like becoming a musician. You know, you can't just pick up a guitar unless you're like a savant or a prodigy or something. You can't just pick up a guitar and be able to be a virtuoso. You have to practice. You have to play. You have to try, you know, to learn more every day and to record your results, record your progress, which is key.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, and so, you know, the college has some really great people. I mean, I consider myself great, but there's also a lot of great
people. Of course.
I mean, Peter Carroll's there, Nikki Ward, Julian Vain, you know, Randy Dukes. That's just Dave Lee. Just a bunch of awesome who's who are on that. And, you know, I was kind of humbled when I got in. And I could start teaching classes. I taught a few classes. And the good thing about the Arcanorium is that it's kind of forum-based. And I've been kind of working, you know, on stuff, teaching. There are a few classes, but all the old classes are still there, so you can see what other people said. And it's not just like, here's only two classes going on. It's like hundreds of classes where you can get, the teacher may not be actively like responding at that time because you have to respond when you're teaching the class, but there's all the back classes. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. There's hundreds of classes in there. Really, there's almost anything you can think of you could probably learn. And most of the people tend to take a very similar approach to what I have in my book. It's very hands-on. It's very, you know, let's get down to the minimum that you need to get the results going, and let's get down to business. So it's I've really been really enriched by my experience at the Arcanorium.
Well, that sounds great. Now, you know, I'm looking at over it now there, again, as I have several times already, and there are so many articles and so much in the way of curriculum on this site. And that's key, too, I think, with a lot of these. People need to look closely at what you join and what you give your energy and your money to, because a lot of times, you know, you're being something that's sort of is not what it appears is being foisted upon you. You know, a lot of false reality going on, a lot of smoke and mirrors and misdirection, and people can easily just kind of throw together a site and make it appear like it's offering you something. But this one clearly is what it appears to be, and I, again, haven't had experience, and this is sort of like the new form, the new incarnation of the what used to be like correspondence occult schools, you know, like the Boda and other courses that could be had through correspondence in the old days, you know, in the 20s or whatever, or through purchasing volumes or systems, mail order, you know, and in that same way, this is the new virtual you know, transmission of the knowledge, transmission of the light, the lamp, you know, and it's exciting. I would be excited and I would be humbled as well that you sound as far as being included in this amazing array of people, like you said, the who's who, the faculty here. It's very exciting.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So having said that, you know, I would like to put in a request that maybe you could put in a good word for us with Peter Carroll and have him join us for a chat here on the Middle Chamber sometime.
Because, well, I'm going to have to try. It's hard.
I'm sure he's, yeah, because, you know, his level of people's awareness of his work, it becomes hard to divide up your time with a lot of other people. But, boy, if it ever came up, we sure would like to have a conversation. I'm sure our listeners would enjoy it as well.
Indeed, indeed.
So, okay, so let me ask you, what's you've got this webinar coming up in July, and that's exciting. Is there any other events or any other new things on the horizon from Andrea Vitimus? You have taken a back seat to doing the more active podcasts, as you told us last time, with Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole, but you do have a book that you're trying to get out, at least one, if not two, you know, that you're trying to get out, and you've got webinar series. Is there anything else going on?
Well, I'm almost certainly going to do a second webinar in in September, in the first week of September. So that will be on specifically Chthonic Journeying and Shapeshifting. So this is actually a class in Journeying, and it's going to be in line with the Left Hand Path conference that I'm going to, which, if anyone is interested, the Left Hand Path conference is going to be like July 18th. It's going to be out in Indy. I can get the exact address, but in that class, I'm going to teach a class on atavistic shapeshifting, which is basically how you're looking at your DNA and understanding the evolution that it is going through, like how we evolved from different animals, and reclaiming those kind of primal aspects of mind. This becomes very, very important. So you're reclaiming your kind of animal instincts and the whole base nature, which some systems very much avoid. They kind of act like it doesn't exist. Instead, I'm taking the philosophy of going back and reclaiming it so you can get better control over it and better use out of it, to really use it when you need it. And then the next webinar in September after the Left Hand Path conference is going to deal with, okay, now you've been able to express and get a handle on those baser, more animalistic instincts that are under the surface. What if we journey to places like the underworld, you know, or even darker places? Not because we particularly want to do harm to anyone, but we want to learn to control the forces that are influencing us in a more pronounced manner, in a more effective manner. So that means, can you stand in somewhat darker places and still be a light? Can you learn to be a light in those darker places? Hard questions. Real magic.
Yes, it is. That is the separation of the big dogs from the little dogs.
a little bit. And in some ways, that webinar is stuff I've been doing for years too, and I've really liked doing the webinars because they're easier than writing a whole book, and you can actually be more clear because people can ask questions. After that, in October, I'm going to Crucible in the first week, and then going out to the Western Mystery Conference in Texas the week before Halloween. So this should be October.
Excuse me, Andrea, what was the September conference? I don't think I got that one from you. You said
I'm going to run another webinar.
Oh, so that'll be the webinar conference. Okay.
That'll be the advanced atavistic shapeshifting and journeying. Essentially, we're going to teach people how to journey to what is, would be generally considered darker or more dangerous places on the astral plane, and learn how to shine a light, how to be a light in those places, even though they're more dangerous. Simply put, because they have influence over our world, and if you can learn to control those kinds of forces, you can control their influence here. So not just kind of the dead, but darker things like demons and other things, which all have a place in the universe. There's good and there's bad, there's light, there's dark. All these things are part of the universe. And to explore and control those parts is kind of what the shaman does in balance.
Okay. Well, that's powerful stuff. Now, you know, we're going to be bringing this conversation to a close here. I wanted to give you a chance, though, to sort of open it up to you and give you the opportunity to kind of just to convey to the listeners anything you think is really the biggest message for postmodern magic 2014, you know, what would be to you vision 2014 as far as postmodern magic goes?
Believe nothing. Try it out.
Nice. Short and sweet. Application, practical application over just blind faith,
I guess. Yeah. Even do not believe the historical accounts, because you can't trust those either. And I could go into a whole lot of history of why that is, but anyone listening who has some history background knows that History is just written down sort of propaganda in a way. The winners really do dictate a lot about what the history is. And so don't use those as guides. You know, use the materials as guides, but don't accept the truth of it. Accept that there may be no ultimate truth, and figure out what actually works for you. And the Hands-On Chaos Magic does a good job of breaking down the basic techniques so you can figure out which paradigms and other stuff that you would like to work with. And that's really the key. No magic happens just by reading the book. No magic happens by listening to a webinar. The magic happens when you do it and you look at these starting points and kind of figure out how it'll work for you best because you're in the trenches doing it. And that's pretty much the number one thing about postmodern magic, chaos magic, meta magic. Just do it and figure it out. And, you know, try use these things as all this, you know, basically a starting point. And then take your notes, your different things that you did, and then basically keep refining. Keep doing, keep refining, and keep studying your own results and the things you're doing. Whether you're working in crazy pop magic, summoning TV egregores, or, you know, or working the oldest grimoire, it's the same process. You know, study it, but study a little, get down what you're going to do, the basic things, but really do a lot more than to study. You'll see that in the process of going out there and doing stuff and not accepting that any book is absolutely right, although, you know, I like my book, but, you know, people have, people take it and modify it and they run with it, which is very clear in my book that I want you to do that. But the key there is that they've internalized it because they've done it. They see what works for them and what gives them trouble. That's really the key to this stuff. You know, and then, as Peter Carroll would actually say, you know, do, and you'll figure out the spirituality later.
That's awesome.
Which is actually a lesson from martial arts.
Yeah. Yeah, Aikido and stuff like that. Sure, I agree. You know, you talk about the victors writing the histories, and we know from our familiarity with certain other material, like the Dragon Legacy material, that they're, you know, the European Europan culture has been genocidally wiped out, you know, deliberately. A lot of the magical and shamanistic things that we've discussed today in this conversation with Andrea Vitimus at AndreaVitimus.com, everybody, talking about his book, Hands-On Chaos Magic. This material, I would contend, my major contention is that magical material is Western tradition. It is what's left of the shamanistic Western tradition that's evolved and modified and innovated over time. But basically, this is all we have left of the European traditions that were, you know, that before the church took over consciousness and awareness, you know, and sort of shifted everyone to a certain narrow bandwidth of thinking. And it happened 1,000 years before it happened here in America to the native populations here. It happened 1,000 years before in Europe. And it happens over and over again. Luckily, though, as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, the optimism we have, the hope we have is even in the darkest age, the Kali Yuga, the way out is provided in this reality. The tools are there. So when Andrea speaks of going out and doing it, you know, follow what you think is right. And don't be afraid by the dogma and the propaganda that's been used to condition you to take a look at what quite possibly might be your own lost heritage. And I know what I respect about your work, Andrea, is that you sort of incorporate this almost like Caribbean Islander type magic into your work. I'm not sure the true, you know, the reasons behind that for you personally, your own histories there, but I like it because it offers a substitution to what is lacking in the greater, you know, we all are a melting pot here in America. But I think most of us, even those who you might not believe, could draw from a European heritage and a lot of the the magical traditions we focus on there are what we always focus on, but there's more to it, isn't there? There's a whole other world of magic out in other cultures and other heritages that need to be brought in and incorporated into our thinking if we're considering approaching it in that reality.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. And there is, when you actually start studying that, there's a lot of similarities. I mean, there's a lot of the systems in the West, especially regarding ceremonial magic, are heavily Christian influenced. Heavily Christian influenced. And they come out of heavily Christian ideas in some cases. And even stuff that looks more Judaic in Western ceremonial magic are heavily Christianized. When you start going back to Europe, even with pre-Christian, pre the devil, pre all of that, it looks a hell of a lot like a shamanic thing. There's a lot more similarities between what people are doing with some voodoo traditions. A lot of the sympathetic magic stuff all seems
very universal, right?
Yeah, they have specific cultural aspects to their magic, specific cultural ideas, but there's a lot of undercurrents that have similar. You look at one culture and look at the next, and they have similar ideas in their simplicity.
Are you referring to like what we could call heathenism? The heathenism of the European cultures, pre-Christian heathenisms, that's more the shamanistic type.
Heathenism is one of them, but a lot of the methods that they use, you know, where, oh yeah, there's more of an active thing, but even then, a lot of the methods that are used are similar across cultures. Like, you know, doll magic, actually, it's not the same as European puppet magic, but there is some similarity that a representation of a person or image can be used to do various things to the person, even with healings or hurt people. You know, just like the use of fire in ritual is amazingly similar between a Hindu ritual and some voodoo rituals. These cultures may or may not have had any contact, but it's probably unlikely. You know, Ukrainian and Slavic rituals, you know, have lots of similarities in some cases to some Native American things. It's not that the god forms that are different, the different gods are different, the different spirits are different, but when you look at what they're trying to achieve,
the mechanics are the same.
The mechanics look similar.
Yeah, and like even with Norse, people don't realize, you know, with the Norse traditions, there's so much mysticism, heavily steeped in mysticism. The idea of Odin being the one-eyed god, the reason why he has one eye is because the other eye is turned within. It's a whole idea about the mystic journey. I mean, it's so shamanistic. So I completely get what you're saying.
Yeah, man, that's not to say everything's the same, but when you start seeing similarities across culture, you have to start asking, okay, what's going on here? And you can actually study that. Like I said, most things are out there now. So, you know, and I'm not talking about just throwing things together without study, but you can start to look at what are the underpinnings here, what's going on here, and kind of, if you are so inclined, make your own system of magic based on those underpinnings.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Andrea Vitimus from AndreaVitimus.com, author of Hands on Chaos Magic, thank you so much for taking the time and for you to sit with us and chat. We really appreciate the conversation. And as always, we get something out of everything we hear from you, and we're really glad that you're out there. We hope you keep up the great work that you have begun.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And I would love to invite you to, when you finish this book of fire magic, we'd love to review the material and have you come back on and talk about it with us.
Well, I would certainly love to. Well, it's probably a year out at least, given how slow it's going.
Oh, I understand. Believe me, I commiserate, brother. I do. So, all right. Well, great. And I just want to thank all the listeners who showed up. And as usual, we will be coming at you next week with another great episode of the Middle Chamber, we'll be talking to Dr. Colin Ross about MKUltra, mind control, and psychiatry. And we're really excited about that show as well. And then after that, we've got E.A. Coetting coming back on to discuss his Anthology of Sorcery, the new book that he's just put out over at BecomeALivingGod.com. So again, Andrea Vitimus, thank you so much for your time, and have a great week and weekend.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Hey, y'all. Materx here. Wow, what a great talk with Andrea Vitimus. So much to think upon. Sorry to have missed it, but sometimes duty calls and only mom can fix it. I'm glad you all have joined us once again, and I hope you've enjoyed our recent shows. Please do also visit our website, middlechamberfx.wordpress.com and freemantv.com, for access to our older shows as well. We've been thinking of adding a musical segment to the show, so I and we can share some of the sounds that resonate with us. And so in light of a great chat about magic, I wanted to close the evening with a song I felt encapsulated an inner magical experience. So often in my life, Bjork's music has moved me in ways hitherto unimaginable. I first saw her with the Sugar Cubes opening for U2 in their Achtung Baby tour in 1992. They were amazing, and I followed her loosely ever since. In my opinion, she is one of the musical geniuses of our age. This song is Crystalline on the album Bastards. Enjoy it as I have. Namaste, good night, and we'll see you next week with Colin Ross.
Crystalline, with our heart. Crystalline, we change. Yay!